Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the iPro MRSA Project conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Ms. Esmeralda Guzman. Ma'am, you may begin.
Good afternoon. As the operator mentioned, this is Esmeralda Guzman from iPro, and welcome to today's presentation. We appreciate you joining us for this afternoon's conference call. Today's topic area will focus on antimicrobial stewardship, charting a course for sensible antibiotics use. Those of you on the listserv are forwarded via email a copy of the slides that will be referenced during the presentation. If you did not receive a copy of the slides and the evaluation form, you can visit the MRSA iPro website at jenny.ipro.org/MRSA under the link for today's presentation. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded and will be emailed to you and posted to the Jenny website to make available for future review. As mentioned, all of your lines are currently muted, but following the presentation, we will be opening the lines up for questions, comments, and further discussion. We are very pleased to have as our guest speaker Dr. Belinda Olszewski, Assistant Professor of Internal Medicine, the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Montefiore Medical Center. She is also the Director of the Antimicrobial Stewardship Program at Montefiore. And now I will turn the floor to Dr. Olszewski.
So thank you for the introduction, Esmeralda, and it's nice to join you all. One thing I'll say is it's a little unnatural to give a talk like this since I can't really see all of you, but I hope that this is fairly informal, and what I'm going to do is sort of take you on a trip to try to at least convince you why I think that antimicrobial stewardship is needed, especially in terms of showing antimicrobial use and showing how common it is and what its ramifications are. Links between use and resistance, basically the grim status of antimicrobial development. Then I'm going to sort of give you a little bit of a flavor about the data that sort of gives you the background as to why or does antimicrobial stewardship work. What are the specific activities that sort of are contained in antimicrobial stewardship? What are some of the challenges in developing one, especially the ones that we've grappled with in our somewhat young program, which is about a year and a half old? Then I'm just going to sort of tell you the status of sort of local stewardship activities in terms of our area, and then highlight just a couple of use, resistance, and adverse event issues in the region sort of to give you an idea of how stewardship might work. So with that in mind, I know you guys are looking at the slide. That was the itinerary. I'm going to take you through and basically tell you that stewardship is really the careful and responsible management of something entrusted to one's care, i.e. the stewardship of natural resources. And so I really think that that also is a good word for antibiotics and antimicrobials. And especially antimicrobial stewardship is really a healthcare institution program to ensure appropriate antimicrobial use. And really its primary goals are to optimize clinical outcome while minimizing unintended consequences, including toxicity, you know, the emergence of selected pathogens such as C. diff or MRSA, and always secondary, but obviously something that is important to administrations are that we can also reduce healthcare costs without adversely impacting quality of care. And I really want to emphasize that although, you know, the motivation by many administrators are this is a cost-saving activity, that that should always be secondary to really doing the right thing and, you know, really improving quality of care for the patient. So I don't think that it's really a stretch to convince you that there's a lot of inappropriate antimicrobial use out there, and it's fairly common. Just to sort of put it in perspective, antimicrobials account for about 30% of hospital budgets, and data seems to suggest that as many as 50% of antimicrobial regimens are really inappropriate. But when you look at the literature, I would just say that there's really varying definitions for what's inappropriate. It may be unnecessary or excessive, i.e. that, you know, it's not needed and this person doesn't really have an infection, or it may actually even be inadequately treating somebody, such as that, you know, maybe it doesn't cover the spectrum, maybe there's redundancy of antibiotics, et cetera. Whatever different definition you use, I think that over the next few minutes, I'm hoping I'll convince you that this type of inappropriate use is associated with increased morbidity and mortality, increased length of stay, adverse events, cost, and increase in antimicrobial resistance. And so we're up to the next slide where it's unnecessary antimicrobials, where do we go wrong? And so I think one of the things that's interesting to look at, this was a sequential study where the authors, Hecker et al., basically looked at sequential patients getting antibiotics. And what they found is that many of the antibiotics were really unnecessary. And almost a third, the duration of the therapy was longer than needed. 32% or almost a third also had either a non-infectious or non-bacterial syndrome. 16% were treatment of colonization or contamination, and 10% were redundant, i.e., such as, let's say, somebody who had two different antibiotics that might both be covering the same spectrum, such as, you know, double anaerobic coverage. In terms of inappropriate antimicrobial therapy, this is on the next slide. This was an ICU study, and basically, you know, where do we sort of go wrong? And what it sort of showed in terms of inappropriate therapy is that, you know, we may make mistakes in community-acquired or hospital onset, but especially where, you know, the wrong choice might be made would be someone who may have come in from the, you know, community initially, but now has something which looks, you know, healthcare acquired, and that the spectrum of what was chosen in terms of the antibiotics for the patient, you know, may not really, you know, cover those hospital-acquired pathogens. The next slide has inappropriate antimicrobial therapy and what its impact is on mortality. And I think one of the issues is that, you know, what we're looking at is trying to improve the choices of antimicrobials, but remember, up front, if we get it wrong, we can really have a serious impact on the patient. And so this basically looked at if an appropriate or inappropriate therapy was picked for some ICU patients. And what they basically found is that the mortality was tremendously more in those where if you didn't get it right up front and really cover for the types of pathogens the patient might have, that the mortality was significantly higher. On the next slide, the question is, well, if you need to get the choice right up front, how long do you really have to get it right? And so this study by Lotus et al. Basically suggests that as time goes on, that once you get up to, let's say, you know, greater than 2 days or so, that you really significantly increase the mortality rate for that patient, so that we want to get it right up front, and we want to do it fairly quickly, but on the other hand, we, you know, fighting that there's, you know, tremendous excess of antibiotics. This basically, next slide, shows inappropriate antimicrobial therapy and that it impacts length of stay. This basically had to do with patients who had inappropriate empiric therapy for ventilatory-associated pneumonia. And what they basically showed was that if your therapy was inadequate versus adequate, that basically you had more prolonged MV or mechanical ventilation and an increased length of ICU stay. So I think the other thing is that inappropriate antimicrobial use can lead to adverse events. And these are probably in a small proportion of regimens, but the problem is the effect can be really great because so many patients in a hospital are on antibiotics at any one time. One hospital actually looked, and 27% of adverse events in their hospital were actually related to antimicrobials. Most events are probably mild, but some can be very serious, such as, you know, very serious skin eruptions and renal failure, and it's probably really hard to estimate the exact toll. And then I think really what the growing concern is adverse events such as selection of pathogens like C. diff. And just on the bottom of this slide, I sort of emphasize that, you know, over the last several years, that C. diff has become way more of a problem because there's, an epidemic strain that seems to be tremendously toxic and the patients get sicker from it. And the next slide sort of talks about the risk factors for C. diff. And, you know, the major risk factors for C. diff are exposure to antimicrobials and hospitalization. And almost all antimicrobials have really been implicated in C. diff, but in the recent outbreaks, especially fluoroquinolones. And that C. diff in itself actually is a risk factor for increased length of stay, attributable cost for inpatient care, which is, you know, estimated at probably conservatively being, you know, more than $2,000 to $3,000 plus dollars per episode. That even excludes if the person would to require some surgery for their C. diff. And that if we look at that in terms of the U.S., that's probably greater than $3.2 billion annually, and also is associated with attributable mortality at 30 days and 1 year that's increased. The next slide basically looks at that, you know, this costs money, too, if you inappropriately use antibiotics. And so this just is a top 10 therapeutic classes of expenditures for some hospitals together, and you can see that this is, you know, large chunk of change here that systemic anti-infectives are, you know, way up on the list in terms of total expenditures, and this was even in 2005. And so there's obviously direct expense for the excessive medications, but remember there's also going to be some cost involved indirectly in terms of some of those other outcomes that I just showed you, such as increased length of stay or adverse events. And that certainly that there is some pretty strong data that resistance also adds to expense, so that if you bred resistance in your patient's infections. This next slide just reminds me to show you, this is from, you know, the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System, or NIST, and the data is a few years old, but I think the trend still holds that there are, you know, increasing rates of resistance amongst several key pathogens, you know, gram-negatives such as Pseudomonas and E. coli, MRSA, VRE, et cetera. So one of the issues is, I mean, why are we doing all these things related to antibiotics? And I think it's really because their antimicrobial use is really strongly associated with resistance. And, you know, it's very tough sometimes to prove that things necessarily that are associated are causal, but I think that the following factors really support that there probably is a causal link between antimicrobial use and resistance, especially because there's more resistance in healthcare associated than community-acquired infections. Those with healthcare-associated resistant infections are more likely to have had prior exposure. Areas within the hospital that have the highest rates of resistance also have the highest rates of antimicrobial use, and the duration of antimicrobial exposure increases colonization with resistant organisms, which can be a risk factor for infection in the future. So, you know, even if you don't believe that this is all causal, I think that use probably causes selective pressure to breed resistance. And so the next issue, which I don't know if you guys are listening or watching this live rather than the paper, you just heard the moo, is that of this cow down on the bottom, is that it's not just really us who are using antibiotics, and it's really also that they're used in other places such as in animals, including in feed to promote growth in cattle, poultry, and swine, to treat sick animals and to prevent diseases where animals may be more susceptible, such as a whole herd or flock if one animal becomes sick. And I think what really illustrates that the use and our resistance may be linked to some of this use in animals is the Campylobacter story, where, you know, there were chickens who basically had feed that had quinolones in it. And thereafter, when they looked at several different organisms that were cultured from these chickens, they were actually resistant. And so I think it shows that there's a, you know, potentially the use here may be pushing towards resistance. So the next slide is basically, you know, we have bad bugs and we have no drugs coming, is because if we had lots of new drugs coming down the road, there would be not so much of an issue that we would need to, you know, be so worried about our antibiotic use, et cetera. But I think the real issue is that this graph or table basically illustrates, and this is from a review article from Clinical Infectious Disease, is really that there are not very many new antimicrobials that are coming out. And in fact, in terms of antibacterials, even the few that have come out in the last several years, many of them are sort of cousin or copycats of other drugs and not necessarily unique new classes. And so just to sort of put it in perspective, I mean, for me, is that if you look at erectile dysfunction medications, there's more of those coming out in the last several years than there are new antibiotics. And so, you know, it's really the perfect storm, because for a drug company, there's not all that much return on investments. There's high cost and low return. And for many of these, even if they were to start to develop new drugs, it often takes many years for, you know, drugs to come out. And so I think that's especially why the argument is that even if you can't prove the causal link between antimicrobial use and resistance, that basically we have very few drugs coming down the road and that we really want to preserve what we have. I think, you know, if all of these are not good enough motivators why we would want to really be more cautious with our antibiotics, I think the other thing that has really put this in perspective is that others are watching and judging our antimicrobial use and resistance. And so what I just mentioned on this slide is I'm sure that for many on the phone, it's not, you know, new news that there are regulatory bodies such as the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services or CMS who've been monitoring a number of quality measures at hospitals. And two of those those measures in particular have to do with community-acquired pneumonia and surgical antimicrobial prophylaxis. And in addition to, you know, grading facilities and actually reimbursing for, you know, data right now, which in the future may actually be reimbursement based on how well we do, this is also shared with the public in terms of comparing the rates that different hospitals have for these measures on, you know, a website that can be looked at by any patient, et cetera. I think also, just to put this in perspective, is that consumer advocacy groups such as Consumer Union have really been promoting state legislation for, you know, transparency and sharing of mandatory reporting of healthcare-associated infections. And so this really, again, makes it such that, you know, we have many motivators to basically look at our antibiotic use, but especially now we have external parties that are looking at our use as well. So, you know, just to step back, even as a physician myself, you know, what are the factors that really influence antimicrobial use? And I think, you know, honestly, there aren't people out there and physicians saying, you know, I'm going to prescribe antibiotics poorly today. I think that there are just certain things that, you know, make it tough for physicians to, you know, in terms of their antibiotic choices. In the outpatient setting, I think it's a little simpler that, you know, there's often a patient who has expectation for antibiotics, and sometimes it is tough to explain to someone that something may be viral and may not need antibiotics. This very interesting article that I have over on the slide basically talks about motivators in the inpatient setting for using antibiotics. And I think some of the issues that they really brought out that may make it tough when clinicians are picking their antibiotics to get it right up front are that, you know, patients are more complicated, that in a teaching facility, often the person who is prescribing is a trainee and may be the least experienced person on the team. Inpatients are increasingly more acutely ill and complex. There are pressures to keep lengths of stay short, and so therefore there's less really watch-and-wait type mentality. Really the first priority is to prevent a disaster in the first 24 hours, and there may be data that is delayed that would come back, and so, you know, I think that there is more of a motivation than to preemptively treat or empirically treat so that you do not miss an emergency. And then I think that really for the clinicians that there's an underestimate of the downside to inappropriate antimicrobials, you know, both one at a time in terms of each patient that they see and in aggregate, that, you know, even though they may understand that there's issue of resistance, when you see that one particular patient, it's often hard to say, I'm going to shorten the course or I'm going to withhold antibiotics on this particular patient. So much so that I think that what I put on the next slide has to do with the 12 steps to preventing antimicrobial resistance from CDC, and I almost think that this sort of fits into that, you know, 12-step type program. Hi, Dr. Ostrowski and I overuse antibiotics, and they say, hi, Dr. Ostrowski, and here are the things that I'm going to try to do to, you know, decrease resistance. And I think one thing that really struck me as I look at the 12 steps that CDC illustrated here is that the ones in the brackets, you know, more than half of them really relate to use of antimicrobials wisely. So with that in mind, I think I hope that I've convinced you that looking at our antibiotic use is really important. And so what I'd like to do is look at, does antimicrobial stewardship work? What are really the components of an antimicrobial stewardship, and what are some of the challenges? And so with that, I think the question is, do antimicrobial stewardship programs work? And actually, most of the data to support this is from inpatients, adults, and ICUs. But the data seems to suggest that comprehensive programs have consistently demonstrated decrease in antimicrobial use, savings of, you know, several hundred thousand dollars. And what's really important is that it does not have to be in a large teaching facility, that there's been success in different types of facilities, both from large academic to small hospitals. And so, you know, there may be ways to tailor programs to every patient, you know, to every, you know, facilities type environment. So the next thing basically is to say that this isn't just something rogue, that there are guidelines out there. And in fact, just to point to, and many people have probably already seen these national guidelines published by the Infectious Disease Society of America in 2007. One issue is that many facilities were probably doing elements of stewardship even before these guidelines came out, even my own facility, but they may not have been under one umbrella they may not have had a dedicated team, and also importantly, they may not have had a formal ongoing program and tracking of processes and outcomes. So for example, at my own facility, they have an extensive restriction system, but these were done basically by the infectious disease trainees, and there wasn't necessarily, you know, a dedicated team to do this and someone tracking how we were doing with things. Also, I think one issue about these guidelines is that they're not exactly a blueprint as to how you do this at your own facility. I think it's basically a very good summary of what types of things work and what the data is to support those things, but it really doesn't tell you how to operationalize these and practically put them in place at your facility. And so I think that that's what many facilities are really grappling with right now, is how do I take this and do this at my facility. I want to just review on the next slide the components of an antimicrobial stewardship program. And basically what the IDSA guideline especially discusses is the core activities, which are having a dedicated stewardship team, which is multidisciplinary, and the things that basically have the stars on them, as I back up, are the ones that have the strongest data to support. The second core activity is formulary restrictions and pre-authorization. And I'm going to describe that in a little more detail, of basically having a set list of antibiotics that you have at your facility and having certain that, you know, are can only be used with some sort of review by the stewardship team. The next would be prospective audit, intervention, and feedback, which is that you look at the charts at a set time period into the hospitalization, and you basically feedback information to providers and ask them to potentially make certain changes in the antibiotic regimen, such as maybe stopping antibiotics or decreasing them down to a less broad spectrum. Some of the supplementary strategies are streamlining or de-escalation of therapy, which is similar to what I just discussed, dose optimization, parenteral to oral conversion, guidelines and clinical pathways, education, antimicrobial order forms. And then antimicrobial cycling and combination therapies are also discussed, but there's really less data to support these. So just moving along in terms of development of the antimicrobial stewardship team, I think one of the important things is to have dedicated personnel. That doesn't mean that the person has to do this 100% of the time, but I think it is hard if they have many other hats that they're wearing and they're not dedicated towards this task. And the other thing in terms of multidisciplinary is that a number of places call themselves a stewardship program, but I think that there's certain key personnel that really need to be involved, and the IDSA guideline talks about having a physician with infectious disease training and pharmacists who have a PharmD with either infectious disease, antimicrobial expertise, or some sort of training in stewardship. Then, you know, I can't emphasize enough that you really need support from administration, because if you're out there and trying to get people to change their practices, not everybody's always going to be happy about, you know, some of these interventions, and the administration really needs to back you on these. And then you really need many other strong liaisons within the facility. They may not have to be the worker bees that do the activities, you know, on a daily basis, but you basically need strong liaisons with the pharmacy and therapeutic committee, such that, you know, this is a committee that basically helps bring certain antibiotics into the hospital, and it would be silly that you would be trying to control certain antibiotic use and yet you would not have some sort of liaison with those parties that bring the antibiotics into the hospital. You need strong links with infection control and healthcare epidemiology. Stewardship basically sort of concentrates on that you may be breeding resistance within a particular patient, but you could control antibiotics tremendously, and yet if the infection control were not good at the facility, a patient could be admitted and, resistance could be transferred to patients because of infection control breaches. So, it's really looking at the same issue in terms of trying to promote, decrease in resistance, and you really need a partnership with your infection control and healthcare epidemiology people. Microbiology for testing and for antibiograms, safety and other quality people at the hospital, and also health information technology, because there's, you know, quite a bit of data that will really help in terms of getting your baseline information and also tracking outcomes such as aggregate antibiotic use, and you really need to capture that data from your computer systems if they are available. So then just moving on to some of the activities in a little more detail, the core formulary restriction and pre-authorization, I just sort of talk about the pros and cons. And the first thing I wanted to sort of illustrate is that there are two big strategies for programs, and many programs actually are moving towards having both these strategies, and many of them are even moving to the second strategy I'm going to show you in a minute. But in terms of pre-authorization, basically, I consider this, and many people consider this, front end. And that's because you restrict the antibiotics up front. And this is very effective in terms of controlling antimicrobial use, and it may be useful in terms of certain healthcare-associated outbreaks. But the con is that there's less evidence that it really reduces long-term antimicrobial resistance. It may just shift the use and resistance in your facility. So you may tighten up the antibiotics up front on certain, broad antibiotics, but you may just be pushing people to use something else, and that may not overall really change your resistance patterns for the positive. The effectiveness really depends on who's making the recommendation, and so there are studies where people who are not trained in infectious diseases are those who are vetting the cases, and, the data is not really strong that that type of system works. I think the other thing that's really key is that being strong up front and making people justify their use, it may be appropriate up front, the antibiotics that are chosen, but that doesn't mean that several days into the hospitalization, when more is known about the patient, that the antibiotic is still appropriate. And so basically the formulary restriction and prior authorization with justification doesn't really do very much to control the length of antibiotic use. And so that's one of the weaknesses to programs that just have a lot of sort of policing up front. That's the other thing, is that prescribers often feel like they have less control. And although my program really started out with a lot of this very front-end, controls, one of the issues is that prescribers really feel like, you're the antibiotic police. So the other big strategy is prospective audit with intervention and feedback. And this has actually been shown to improve antimicrobial use in facilities of different sizes. And the data does also show that it decreases C. diff, cost, and resistant gram-negative infections. And benefits have been shown in hospitals even when daily review is not feasible, such as smaller private hospitals where there may not be a full-time ID physician. You may be able to even look at things a few days a week and still be able to show impact. I think the con to this is that it's very labor-intensive. Part of it is that you, at least in my hospital, finding ways to identify the opportunities to intervene are hard because we have many, many patients at any one time on antibiotics. And so you may have to go through many lists of patients, which may not necessarily be electronic, to be able to find the patients on which you really need to feedback information to get the provider to change the antibiotic. But this can be facilitated by certain computer surveillance and software. And just as I mentioned at the front end was the restriction and justification, type system, this is really more the back-end approach. And many programs are really moving more to this back-end approach with auditing and feedback because it seems that this doesn't just change what people are using up front. It really also changes the length of the use of antibiotics. These are just the supplementary strategies in terms of streamlining or de-escalation. This is when the culture results become available to move to more targeted therapy, a discontinuation of empiric therapies, including redundant based on clinical status and negative cultures, and there's pretty good data to support this. Dose optimization, which is especially based on the patient, their age, their renal function, their weight, the causative agent, the site of the infection, and then some pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. And I think this is especially a place where the involvement of the PharmD is so key. For myself as an infectious disease physician, and especially for the fellows, I think that the PharmDs really add that element of more, practically using the antibiotics. And, one of the things that we're looking at our program especially is really optimizing vancomycin use. And there's pretty good data to support that these dose optimizations really do work. The next two supplemental strategies are parenteral to oral conversion or IV to PO. Basically enhanced by availability of certain antimicrobials allow for conversion or initiation to oral therapy, and especially the ones that are, the easiest are quinolones, fluconazole, and metronidazole. Some people also have other, conversions that have to do with, you know, clinical pathways and streamlining down, but the easiest is really ones where there's just good bioavailability. Studies have shown that this really can reduce length of stay and cost, and this is often something easy and sort of like low-lying fruit for a program that is just starting out, especially because not only is it good that the person may be able to go home sooner because the intravenous needle comes out and they can take things orally, you know, decrease potential line infection, but it also can save some money, and, you know, that's something that you can turn around and show your administration so that if you need to spend some money on certain things, you may be able to show that you're paying for, you know, paying for yourself. Guidelines and clinical pathways, these are taking national guidelines and incorporating local microbiology and resistance. You know, multidisciplinary teams may be needed to make the development, and there's very good data, for example, that their successes with, like, community-acquired pneumonia. Education, this is essential, but actually the data is that education alone without an intervention is pretty marginal, so that if I just go out and try to educate providers about, you know, proper use of antibiotics, that alone probably doesn't work. On the other hand, if I'm intervening and reviewing a case and then I have some education that's associated with that, that really works much better. Antimicrobial order forms can be effective. They can be coupled with practice guidelines. These have especially been studied in perioperative prophylaxis orders with automatic discontinuation. There's two other supplementary strategies, combination therapy. This is may have a role in certain clinical contexts or organisms, but for many things, it's just redundant in usual circumstances, and there's insufficient evidence to really recommend this in routine use. And then there's antimicrobial cycling and scheduled switches, which is scheduled removal and substitution of specific antimicrobials, you know, at different times at your institution for particular syndromes. Studies are really limited and vary, and there's really insufficient evidence to recommend this for routine use. So one thing that's really come up over the last several years is computer support to aid stewardship. And there are several software systems that are now available that have supplemented antimicrobial stewardship and infection control. And these can do surveillance data mine for opportunities to intervene, such as we discussed a few minutes ago, automated antibiograms, methods for tracking, documenting, and aggregating, and some decision support. There's pretty compelling data that these systems complement stewardship activities in terms of gathering data to make additional interventions. I think one issue is that this is probably to supplement and not to take the place of a human who would actually look and see if, you know, what the information that's being presented really makes sense. The other thing is that even though these may save money, there's obviously money that would have to be spent on that. And even for my own facility, you know, in these economic times, it's hard to get people to spend money on things. And so, you know, I think these are wonderful, but, you know, not everybody's able to afford to put them in place right away. A recent randomized trial has shown that software such as these did double the interventions or the opportunities for a stewardship team to basically make changes, and they were able to, even on a short period of time, show a savings of $84,000. So just in terms of challenges, I'll just call it stewardship in the city on the next slide, is just to tell you a little something about, you know, my facilities. So one of the challenges we had is that we have three facilities, and they're really, it's a pretty large healthcare system. We actually had stewardship in two of the three facilities that are almost 1,200 beds. It's a teaching facility where providers of all different levels actually do the prescribing. And in fact, we have a substantial non-teaching service where we have other than physician type prescribers such as NPs and PAs. The hospitals geographically are separated from each other, and we're urban and inner city, and so there's really a need to prioritize based on resources how much can be spent on some of these activities. The other issue is that we have a very busy emergency room, and this is a main portal into the hospital where many antibiotic courses are initiated. And although we have electronic entry of orders and tracking of antibiotics for most of the hospital, we actually don't have that for the ear. And then there's just institutional culture. We have a fantastically strong ID, pharmacy, microbiology departments, but there just are institutional cultures as to how things were done in the past, and so sometimes changing how people do things, you know, is growing pains. So with that, what I'm going to do is just take you for the local status of stewardship. In terms of, you know, our facility, our efforts have really been directed at the inpatient area because that's where the data is really best, and that's honestly where some of our largest and broadest antibiotic use are. Not that it's not important in the outpatient setting, but this seemed to be a good place to start. We established a stewardship team, and actually that comprises of myself, and even though up front, a large percentage of my effort is dedicated to stewardship, there are months where I am the infectious disease attending doing regular consultation. And we also have two infectious disease trained PharmDs, each of which dedicate 50% of their effort to this. So it's one FTE, but we're a very large facility. We also established very strong liaisons with all the types of players in the hospital that I described before. One of the motivations really for our program really developing a stewardship was that we actually have a very large infectious disease training program, and we had many formulary restrictions with approvals that are needed, and for the most part, those were really being done by infectious disease trainees. And so one thing is that these trainees, you know, need to do other things, including consultation, and when we did a very extensive assessment of the approval process, we realized that the fellows were taking calls many, many times a day, and that was really prohibitive in terms of them really doing the type of learning and good consultation that they needed to do. And so that was really one of the early motivators. Even though it might not be the first thing I might have put on the agenda was to look at the prior authorization, it really became something that needed to be done because that was the motivators of our department really getting a stewardship going. I think the other issue is that not that the fellows were doing anything bad, it's just that if they had less designated time to this and it was a different fellow every day, there wasn't really any continuity. And so, you know, really to study how effective they were in, you know, saying yes or no to certain antibiotic requests and whether there was consistency in how the approvals were being done. So over the last year to year and a half, the things that we have put into place is a triaging system to take care of issues that might not be a direct approval-related issue. We put into place using our text pagers to help out with our approvals. We have the stewardship team doing most of the approvals during the daytime hours, and we've actually made some adjustments to our overnight system to make it more practical for the fellows and also have more continuity and consistency in the decisions that are made. We're also assessing automation for the approval system. We spent quite a bit of time trying to aggregate baseline data on processes, use, purchasing, resistance, and some adverse events, such as C. diff, so that as we put interventions in place, we know what our baseline are and we're able to show outcomes. Just to quickly mention purchasing, purchasing can be used as a simple surrogate up front to look at how you are doing in terms of your use. One is because you can get defined daily doses of use, and two, you can just get cost. And although this may not be perfect in terms of how antibiotics are being used, it's sometimes an easier measure up front to get, and it may be something that as you get started can be used you know, to sort of see where your problematic areas are and also to see early on if you're having any impact. The other things that we've been very involved in is assisting with guidelines, and I just put in parentheses flows is because we had two main areas where we worked with the multidisciplinary team to put together some flow guidelines to help clinicians in terms of their prescribing. One of them was community-acquired pneumonia related to CMS, and one issue is that this was a good topic to tackle up front because it's one of those that I mentioned that is public in terms of that CMS is looking at this. The other thing is a very common diagnosis, pneumonia. And what we were able to do is we worked with a team from ER and from safety, and we put into place some simple guidelines. The other thing is that we tried to use some novel ways to promote a good use of antibiotics in the ER, and so we're using our Pyxis machine. And our data is really preliminary, but we've shown some improvement in our percentage of initial regimens for community-acquired pneumonia that are appropriate. The other place where I think we've done a lot in terms of guidelines is flu. And you know, one issue is that this is a presentation where I'm doing it by phone, and I sent all our slides, so I did not share with you all our flow guidelines, but we had basically from the beginning a flow that talked about several different issues in terms of testing for flu, who might be appropriate to treat with antivirals. We tackled infection control all on one simple sheet so that providers had a place to go to and on this issue that was rapidly changing. And we had it up on our intranet, and we still do, and that way any changes that need to be made would happen real time and could get out to our many, many providers. We also had educational sessions that were available for this. We put into place formal tracking. We're working on auditing feedback and de-escalation systems, and honestly, that's a tough one just in terms of resources. We've been increasing our IV to PO programs. We've been working on dose optimization, and as I mentioned, we're really focusing on vancomycin. And we've extensively worked with microbiology on C. diff testing, reporting and testing for gram-negative rods such as Klebsiella pneumonia with carbapenemase, or KPC, improving our H1N1 testing from the spring to this fall, having different types of PCR available, and then really reviewing and promoting the use of our antibiograms, which I'll show you in a minute. And then we've had many educational opportunities, and we have a research initiative that we are collaborating with Greater New York Hospital Association related to C. diff. So to trying to extend our activities, one, to make it a little more interesting for the PharmDs, and two, really to make the program not only service-oriented, but really establish a niche at our facility of expertise. So with that in mind, I kind of wanted to sort of put this in perspective, is that when I first took this job and I told my mother-in-law, who is not in medicine, about that I was going to be the antibiotic stewardship person, she said, "You're going to be the antibiotic stewardess?" And at first I was a little insulted, and then I really kind of realized that it wasn't all that far off. And so on this slide, I wanted to sort of give you the parallels between being a stewardess and being the antibiotic stewardship person. So if I was the stewardess, there would be security and boarding to start your flight course. As the antimicrobial stewardship person, we have approval for restricted antibiotics to start your antibiotic course. If you are traveling, you'd need a passport. And if you are in the hospital and prescribing, you really use your antibiogram and not your passport to our local microbiology. And the stewardess sees the world at 35,000 feet. And we see the hospital's use and resistance in aggregate at 35,000 feet, i.e. not just one patient at a time. And your safety is their priority as a stewardess. And your patient's safety and outcome is our priority as the stewardship team. And just in the last year, there was that airplane crash in New York where the plane went down on the Hudson, and everybody touted it as a miracle. And the crew actually was a little insulted, and they said, no, this would really be attributed to careful systems in place exercised by a very skilled team. And I think that that sort of fits for stewardship, too, because I think that most clinicians would not dare give, you know, chemotherapy or do dialysis by themselves, but everybody feels comfortable prescribing antibiotics. And so I think as the stewardship team, we really need to promote ourselves as developing a system that uses a specialized team to promote antibiotic use. So with that in mind, for those of you who are watching the slides, you'll hear the airplane noise. As I like to fly over my hospital in the New York City area and just hit one or two issues related to use, resistance, and adverse events to sort of show you how stewardship might work. And so one thing on the next slide is just to show you that we're all really dealing with C. diff, and especially some of the highest rates of C. diff are in the Northeast. And one of the issues that the stewardship team has dealt with is that there's really no one perfect test for C. diff testing, and especially the toxin tests that are used at many places. They're fairly inexpensive and rapid, but they're not all that sensitive. And so there are a number of other tests that are potentially available, including the GDH test, which is the third one down, which is a very good screen, but it's tremendously sensitive. And may pick up things that are not really toxigenic C. diff. And then there's stool culture, which is very sensitive and actually grows the isolate, but it may be very labor-intensive. There's other modalities, including imaging and endoscopy, and several articles have looked at actually combining testing regimens. And what they sort of suggest is that you use the GDH screen to screen patients, and that if it's negative, it actually has a very good negative predictive value and you need to do no further testing. And if it's positive, you need some way to confirm, just like you might if you screen someone for syphilis with the non-treponemal test, you need a treponemal test. Here, if you screen by DDH, you need some sort of test to confirm. And so the real issue is the cost and ability to do certain testing. And so one of the things that the stewardship team really helped out with micro and infection control in the infectious disease department is strategies at our own hospital, which was basically a stepwise approach to combined testing. And so on the next slide, I'm just going to walk through that, you know, because you sometimes can't really control a problem if you can't identify all the cases. You may have patients who are an unrecognized burden and then you can't put them on the right infection control. Or maybe, you know, you don't realize which patients have C. diff, so then it's hard to know which antibiotic use to tackle. So before February of 2008, we had the toxin only. And then in February 2008, we moved over to the GDH screening. And what would happen is that then we used our old test, the toxin, to confirm those that were GDH positive. If you were screen negative, you didn't get anything else done. If you were screen positive, then you got the toxin. But if that wasn't positive, at that point, the only other test we had was culture. And so we would actually culture the organism, but it might take up to 2 days for it to really grow, and then we would try to retoxin it. And one of the things is that this tremendously increased how many cases we were picking up. The problem is that it really took 2 days, and so there were issues that the patient might need to be isolated, and so this was a burden in terms of infection control, plus it was sort of complicated reporting, and so there was a lot of educational efforts to get everybody to understand this. One thing is that before we put this in place, because the toxin was not so sensitive, people didn't really believe the testing, and so often we get many requests for treatment for C. diff, or such as P.O. vancomycin, and the thing is that there was, you know, cost associated with treating the patient that didn't really have C. diff. So actually, after the success of this sort of combined regimen, we were able to make the argument that waiting the 2 days for the culture was really not realistic in terms of some of these other downsides, such as the infection control issue and the reporting complexity. And so we moved over from doing the GDH screen and having the first confirmation being the toxin, that if that was not positive, that we would do PCR as a second confirmation test. And one of the issues is that PCR is actually a good test. The problem is it's kind of expensive, and so you really don't want to do it on all the patients. And so this really allowed us to have a sequential change of our testing so that we would only do it on those who were not toxin positive on the first confirmation test. And so this actually allowed us to do everything in 24 hours. We've actually increased our yield by 14%. The test is much more trusted. It's simpler. And I think the issue is at this point we're trying to assess whether, you know, how, what type of impact we have on identifying the C. diff cases, but also our prescribing of antimicrobials for treatment of C. diff. The next thing we did is really optimizing treatment. And so the picture that I have there on the right is really a picture of our treatment guideline for C. diff colitis. And so, you know, some of the things that are discussed are encouraging discontinuation of antibiotics and antiparastolics and antimotility agents, criteria for use of P.O. vancomycin, when to use P.O. vanc plus flagyl, how to do a taper if somebody may have recurrences, and then discouraging certain procedures that may not have good data, such as using both P.O. vanc plus P.O. flagyl where there may not be all that much extra proven benefit. Actually, we do not routinely use probiotics, and actually there's a little discussion about how both in the literature and at our own facility we've seen complications such as bacteremias. There's also some areas of controversy that are discussed, including combined therapy, when to taper, immunoglobulins, and when to encourage ID and GI consultation. The next thing in terms of treatment, which is something that I'm sure many of your facilities do, but if you do not, this is a simple cost-saving maneuver, is to make our own P.O. vancomycin. For many years, we would buy the tablets, which were pretty expensive, and that was one of the motivations for really controlling who got P.O. vancomycin for C. diff. And now, actually, I have Julia Child there because our farm, DE, actually did taste tests, and for those patients who take it orally, over on the side you can see these are basically the syringes that have RPO vancomycin with some cherry flavoring in it. And the other thing we've done is optimize dosing to encourage the 125 dosing and only the really the higher use dosing for enemas, et cetera. The next thing, just in terms of C. diff, where the stewardship has really been involved, is that actually many of your facilities may be involved in the Greater New York Hospital Association and United Hospital Funds collaborative related to C. diff. This is a collaborative of 44 hospitals in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut that have collected data related to C. diff since March of 2008. And they use standard definitions for C. diff, baseline rates of C. diff per 10,000 patient days for both for the facilities and for in aggregate for the whole collaborative, education to participating sites, and put into place a tiered bundle of infection control and environmental interventions to prevent C. diff. They have tools for data collection on adherence, and as I mentioned, they have rates of C. diff that are shared from the facilities. And so one of the issues is the next step is really to look at stewardship, because we sort of discussed early on that good infection control and environmental cleaning may do some things, but that doesn't mean that patients couldn't basically breathe their own C. diff from getting too many antibiotics. And so actually Montefiore is collaborating with Boston University and the Greater New York Hospital Association on a project funded by AHRQ and CDC actually to look at the effect of stewardship on C. diff in a subset of the facilities in this 44 hospital collaborative. So, you know, with that in mind, as one of the preliminary things that this project looked at is that Greater New York realized that the next step to try to control C. diff might be stewardship. And so I'm going to tell you about three studies that I know of that also sort of take the pulse on stewardship activities throughout the country. So one of them actually is a network of infection control and healthcare epidemiologists that I was involved in with SHEA and APIC, which are the Society for Healthcare Epidemiologists, and the APIC organization. And this had to do with looking at multi-drug resistant organism activities back in 2006 and 2007. And we actually had a poster abstract at SHEA. And what we did is ask people about their rates of certain multi-drug resistant organisms and what things they were most worried about. But in addition, we asked whether facilities had a designated or formal antimicrobial stewardship program. And at that time, almost 60% said they did not, which means only 41% did. The EIN, which is the Emerging Infection Network, which is basically a survey of infectious disease doctors through the Infectious Disease Society of America, recently did a survey on just antimicrobial stewardship. And what they found is that only 54% of the respondents, who were, you know, several hundred respondents throughout the country and Canada, had stewardship programs. And then in terms of this collaborative that I just chatted with you about related to the Greater New York Hospital Association and C. diff, they surveyed the 40-some-odd people in the collaborative, and the data is preliminary, but only 16 indicated that they had a stewardship, and most of them really had a very young stewardship, i.e. less than 2 years, much like my own program. And I think one of the issues is that, you know, that we have very strong infectious disease and a number of other issues that I'm going to talk about in a minute. And for the most part, although there are exceptions, I think that in the New York area, there are many programs that are still in their infancy. And so there is ripe opportunity for us to look at stewardship kind of together, because I think that this is really an area where the New York region can really do some wonderful things. This is just a little cartoon, and this little guy basically says, hey, kid, want to be a superbug? Stick some of this in your genome, and even penicillin won't be able to harm you. And this is a guy who took a shortcut through the kitchen, and he basically met the antibiotic resistance. And so I'm just going to finish off with that. This story is a case that I used to talk to the house staff about using Pseudomonas or treatment for Pseudomonas at our facility. And I just mentioned this, a 70-some-year-old guy, and he comes in from a nursing home, and he's had several hospitalizations. And so basically short of breath, and he has fever and infiltrates. And so the ER tells me that he's panallergic, and they want, you know, something to treat his pneumonia. And one of the things that I just always illustrate to the house staff is that we really want to know what the allergy is to any medication. And one of the things is that I use our antibiograms, and so I chose not to show you all the rates of R resistance at our hospital because probably my administration would not be so thrilled with me to do that. But I just wanted to sort of show you that because if what I do is basically I took our antibiograms, which are annually for many different organisms, and I actually plotted them, and we're very fortunate that we have a strong micro lab, and I actually plotted, you know, some 20-some-odd years at least our MOSES facility. And what I'm able to show is that it's important for people to really get a good allergy history because for many organisms such as Pseudomonas, we've really seen a decreasing amount of sensitivity, percentage sensitivity, so certain antibiotics that have really been, you know, overused tremendously, such as the quinolones and aztreonam. And so, yet, some of the other agents, such as imipenem or the other beta-lactam antibiotics, may still have preserved sensitivity. And so it's a teaching point that I really try to take the antibiogram and make it real for the house staff so that when they make their decision, it's not that I'm just an antibiotic police and I don't want to give out, you know, IV Cipro because of its expense, et cetera. It's that I'm really trying to show them that it may not cover some of our gram-negative rods as well, and that maybe we want to really preserve it for someone who has a very significant allergy where we're unable to use some of the beta-lactams, and that we preserve the medication for, you know, that such situation, and that way it works when we need it to. So some of the places where I've used is gram-negative rods, especially Pseudomonas, with the quinolones and aztreonam, and I also show it for Staph aureus for MRSA just to illustrate why some of our empiric use may be certain ways. And so we, you know, there was a question that I think Esmeralda brought up about how places use their antibiograms. You know, just based on the amount of labor, we actually do it annually. We do it for each of our facilities, and we're able to aggregate out the antibiotic or the antimicrobial susceptibilities for outpatients and inpatients. Some facilities are able to do this on a shorter time frame, such as every 6 months, and some places can do unit-specific. That would be harder at my facility. So I just wanted to finish off with some of our successes. I think over the last year and a half, one of the important things is visibility and credibility, that we just don't want to be the antibiotic police. And I think that even though it's never good to have an outbreak of any infectious disease in your area, that in some senses flu helped us with this because we were able to show that as a team we were primed to help the institution make decisions and especially, let's say, make decisions about how testing or Tamiflu might be able to be used quickly. In terms of getting baseline data to start to attack the issues, it's very soon for us even to have large outcomes, given that our program is only about a year and a half and that you actually have to spend a decent amount of time to sort of get the lay of the land in your baseline data. But I can tell you that since we've been involved, we've way more formal infectious disease consults. In 6 months, there are probably 200-plus formal ID consults that have come from us looking at charts and really saying this is too complicated. And in the past, they might have asked the ID fellows for informal sort of curbside advice, and we really try to get ID on board sooner, which I think will translate into a better quality of care if a patient has a significant infection. Our ASP, or antimicrobial stewardship program, seems to approve antibiotics less and for shorter periods of time. It's still a large percentage of empiric coverage that we approve, but often when we approve things, we may approve it with conditions such as please get a consult or shorter durations, some suggestion of workup or better dosing. Our ID fellows and attendings are really feel that, you know, this has made things more efficient and there's better morale. And honestly, one of the issues is that in any ID training program, that there are issues now that fellows should not be involved in doing things on patients that they don't take care of. So that where they were doing approvals on patients that they might not consult on, that this makes us more compliant with ACGME. And so over the next few years, other hospitals may come to systems more like this because they are forced to in terms of ID training programs. We've shown some decreased overall restricted antibiotic use. We've decreased our total defined daily doses by about 15%, which is about 10,000 patient days in 6 months of this year compared to 6 months last year. For flu, I think we would have given out way more Tamiflu had we not had systematic approaches to things. And as I mentioned, for CMS and community-acquired pneumonia, we have very promising results on our pneumonia measures. In terms of our advice, if you're planning a stewardship, definitely make sure that you get buy-in and liaisons. You can't really do this alone. And even if you had some wonderful things that you want to do, you really need your backing from administration and many other parties. It really needs to be multidisciplinary. I think it's not so simple to get data or things done, and so really have modest goals. If you start with simple things such as IV to PO, and it's not all about cost saving, but it's nice to show your facility that you can save some money, pick just a few simple things to tackle. There's way more to do than you will ever, than you will have probably resources to do up front. And even for myself, I think it's not so much what to do, it's which things we're able to do and which are the priorities. Don't be so hard on yourself. Find ways to enjoy the process. And although there may be things that are, you know, tedious, such as taking, you know, phone calls for approvals and denying antibiotics, I think the ways that we've made it, you know, more collaborative and more interesting for our PharmDs and for myself is research and collaboration. I think there's tremendous opportunities in this region to take the lead on stewardship. We have some wonderfully strong hospitals that are diverse. We have strong pharmacy and infectious diseases. We have very large patient populations, and we definitely have the existence of emerging pathogens, including C. diff, multi-drug-resistant, you know, gram-negatives. Basically, the start in the home for KPCs is really New York City, and certainly this IPRO initiative is related to MRSA. I think that there's very interesting ongoing activities. There was recently a antimicrobial stewardship certificate program that the Pharmacy Society put together. And then there are collaboratives such as the Greater New York one that I discussed and this IPRO initiative. So I'm enthusiastic that it may be growing pains, but this area has a tremendous opportunity in terms of stewardship. And so I'd like to just finish by acknowledging all the people that work with me here at Montefiore, and the group pictures there are just my PharmDs who are really my partners in crime in doing the stewardship and whom with I could not really do the things that we do. You know, I really think that we each bring different expertise, and those are the ID fellows down at the bottom who are still, you know, tremendously help us with things. So with that, I will just say that I'll take any questions or comments, and these are my twin four-year-olds, and one of my little guys is just going to say, Mommy says antibiotics, don't use them or you'll lose them. And I have my contact information if anybody would like to call or email me. Certainly, we've been through some of the growing pains of trying to get a program together. And so if you're in that position that you are thinking about it or struggling with the day-to-day activities related to how do you get this started, you know, we'd certainly be happy to commiserate with you and answer any questions that we you know, that we can, or certainly lend some advice about how we got certain things to work at our facility. I would say that the main thing is that, you know, that whatever you do, that it's really going to have to be tailored to your facility, and that there's no perfect way to do this. So I thank you for your time, and I wish anybody who's going to do this good luck.
Well, thank you, Dr. Otrosky. Operator, could you give the prompt for questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question at this time, please press the star, the number one key, or your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press the star, the number one key. One moment, please.
Okay. While everyone kind of thinks up of questions, Dr. Otrosky, one thing that you had mentioned to me earlier were those CEO talking points on the JCO website.
Yeah, actually, Joint Commission, and I guess we can look to find it, and I believe that, and it's not that it's supported by a drug company money, but I believe that one of the companies, I have to find out, actually printed it. It's Joint Commission materials that basically talk about addressing your administration in terms of putting in antibiotic controls or an antimicrobial stewardship. And actually, they have, like, slides and talking points that you can use to talk to your administrator. Yeah. So that's something that either you may be able to find. If not, I can find for you for the group.
I'll definitely look for and forward to the group, because I think that's one of the struggles that a lot of the IPs have is getting the support from their administration
to
move forward with a stewardship program. Operator, do we have any questions on the line?
We have a question from Anthony Canoe with Mount Sinai. You may begin.
Hi, Dr. Ostrazi. Thank you very much for your wonderful presentation. My question, if I'm to start this program in my hospital, will the automation help me move faster or just start with the low area like IV to PO with cultures and so on?
You know, honestly, I mean, everybody's going to have what works for them. I would say that probably getting the initial data and starting with something like IV to PO and getting your aggregate use is probably the first step, and then you'll figure out what types of things you need. Because there's a number of softwares out there, and, you know, if you can, one, I don't know that you're going to be able to get administration to buy them for you, but two, you have to sort of figure out what you need before you, because you might get something and it's not going to help you do what you need to do. I definitely think that they look like that they are promising because they're going to give you opportunities on which to intervene, but you still need a human to look at the results. For example, they might pull up all the positive blood cultures, but you might look at them and some of them are Staph coag negative and they're one culture and you'll say that's contamination. You know, the antibody, it's, so there's something that may show you bug-drug mismatches, but if it's a Staph coag negative and that means nothing and the person is on antibiotics for something else, you know, a human has to look at it to decide whether, you know, the suggestions it's making or the patient that it's identifying really makes sense. So I think that they are an accoutrement, but I think that they're not going to be a replacement for getting your baseline information as to what's being used and starting with some simple things like IV to PO.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then number one key. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Well, in the interest of time, I know that you have to get back to your clinic, Dr. Otrosky. Perhaps if people have more questions, you can email them to me and I'll forward them to you and maybe forward the answers to everyone. Because I'm sure that if one person has a question, everyone might have a similar question.
Sure, and it may take time because also if people want to talk about their individual circumstance, they may want to send them to you or they may want to just email or call because, you know, there may be something in specifically that they want to ask about their facility and may not want to air that, you know, sort of with the whole group.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Dr. Otrosky, for a very comprehensive talk today. It was wonderful and very insightful.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, and good luck with your efforts.
Thank you so much. So now I'm going to make a couple of general announcements. Just a reminder to please fill in your teleconference evaluation form and turn them into Eloise Tate. And the next conference call will actually be January 13th, and we will be publishing a calendar by next Monday. And again, thank you again for your interest and ongoing participation. I will now end the call.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. Have a wonderful day.